My name is Ray Choate. I'm the University Librarian here at the University of Adelaide at the Barr Smith Library, and it gives me great pleasure indeed to welcome you here this evening. Many of you are faces I don't know, and so if you're new, I'm pleased to see you here, and if you're new and are interested in this sort of series, I'm sure our secretary will sign you up to get regular communication about future events. Now, the first thing I want to ask you to do is please turn off your mobile phones. And while you're doing that, I would like to acknowledge the Kaurna people, who are the original custodians of the Adelaide Plains and the land upon which the University of Adelaide's campuses at North Terrace, Waite, Theberton, and Roseworthy are built. I have apologies this evening from the president of the Friends of the Library, Jane Lomax Smith, and from Chris Burrell, who is the past president. And I would also like at this stage to note that our patron, Lady Mary Downer, passed away recently when visiting her son in London. Mary Downer was a fifth generation Barr Smith. It was her great grandfather that gave the first grants to the university to buy books for a library. And his family subsequently that made it an endowment, and we're still buying books from the Barr Smith Endowment. It was his son Robert Barr Smith, the great-grandfather. Tom Elder Barr Smith was her grandfather, the son of Robert Barr Smith, and he gave the money to build the Barr Smith Library, which is that building you can see through the windows there, which is now the reading room of the University of Adelaide Library. If you don't know it, do make a detour before you leave this evening. It's the most magnificent room. It's neoclassical, and we're very, very proud of it indeed. Lady Mary Downer was our patron. She was also a generous donator to us and to our annual appeals. But she was a very special and nice person. We shall miss her very much. I have one story I'd like to say, and if you know Mary Downer, you will appreciate this. I came new to the University of Adelaide. We want you to meet Lady Downer. Lady Downer, what do you say to a lady? You know, do you genuflect or what do you do? Yanks have all sorts of curious conceptions about ladies and lords and gentlemen. So I was introduced to her, and I said, oh, hello, Lady Downer, nice to meet you. And she said, no, my name is Mary, call me Mary. So I've always referred to her after that as, hello, Mary, how are you? And she was one of the most down-to-earth people that you could meet, and she will be missed very much indeed. Now, to move to this evening, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, whom I met last night for the first time, who tells me that from the age of 8, when he insisted his mother take him to see a science fiction film called Destination Moon, he has had a fascination for the fact and fiction of spaceflight. I shall have to look that up. It's probably available on DVD, is it? And in 1961, he joined the British Interplanetary Society and was elected a fellow of that society in 73. He obtained his MB, BS, and MD degrees here at the University of Adelaide, and then he went to the University of Nottingham in the UK, where he got his PhD. Subsequently, he's been elected to membership of Sigma Psi, the Scientific Research Society in the United States, and the Physiological Society, my daughter's a physiologist, should be able to pronounce it, Physiological Society in the UK in 1975. He has the most interesting array of books, all of which are here in the Barr Smith Library, and you can borrow them if you'd like to, or at least have a look at them. The first book is called Diving and Asphyxia, a Comparative Study of Animals and Man. Cambridge University Press, 1983, reprinted, 2009, well done. Second book was called Spaceport Australia. The third was Echidnas of Australia, New Guinea, which he co-authored with somebody else. The fourth was a follow-on from that called Echidna, Extraordinary Egg-Laying Mammal. And the fifth one was Project Natter, Last of the Wonder Weapons, the Luftwaffe's Vertical Takeoff Rocket Interceptor. Maybe I better go through that again. I bungled it a bit. Project Natter, The Last of Wonder Weapons, the Luftwaffe's Vertical Takeoff Rocket Interceptor. Sounds fascinating. And finally, his most recent book is called Spacesuit, A History Through Fact and Fiction, which was won an award, won the 2012 Eugene M. Award for Astronautical Literature by the American Astronautical Society. And for your information, if you want to know who the M. Award is, he was NASA's first historian. Dr. Gooden lives in Adelaide, and we are pleased to welcome you here this evening.
Good evening, everybody. I'm going to take you this evening on a journey that has been going on for over 150 years, and it is the journey of the development of the spacesuit. It starts in Paris in 1783. The Montgolfier brothers had designed hot air balloons, and in 1783, two intrepid gentlemen flew one of these off the ground, surgeon Pilatre de Rosière and infantry officer François Laurent. A very, very brave thing to do, of course, because prior to that, only a goat, I think, had been taken up in a hot air balloon. The altitude was 900 meters, the maximum altitude that it reached, and the distance it traveled over Paris was about 16 kilometers. So this was the beginning of man's adventure into the atmosphere. Now, I just want to introduce a little bit of physiology, a little bit of medical material, because this is kind of at the heart of why we need a spacesuit at all. And as we go up into the atmosphere, two things happen. The oxygen is reduced, the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere is reduced, and the amount of air pressure on our bodies is reduced. So on the left-hand side, I've shown altitude in meters, and on the right-hand side, the physiological effects. Now, we're talking here about the acute effects of altitude. We're not talking about people walking up to the top of Mount Everest, where you get chronic effects of altitude. This is the acute effects of altitude. What are the acute effects of altitude as a result of reduced oxygen? Well, if we go to about 3,000 to 6,000, we start to feel a little bit sleepy, we come a little bit confused. I've been told, but I haven't ever experienced it, that it's a little bit like alcohol intoxication. And then if we go a little bit higher, we go to 6,000 plus meters, we have not enough oxygen for normal brain function, so it's possible that we can start to lose consciousness and become unconscious. If we pursue a higher altitude still to 9,000 plus meters, then death could ensue. Now, these things are all very variable from one individual to another. It depends on general fitness and so forth. So, but these are generalizations I'm giving you here. As far as the effects of the reduction of pressure as we go up in altitude, two things can occur, two main things occur. One of them is a phenomenon called decompression sickness, and this can occur around about 7,000 plus meters. This is an effect where the pressure is reduced around the body to the point where the nitrogen dissolved in the tissues comes out as little bubbles, little, tiny little bubbles. And these can interfere with all kinds of physiological function. Two classic features of the bends are pain in the joints, and the other one is called the chokes, where we get some respiratory phenomena. If we go to 19,000 plus meters, then we have reached the point at which water boils at body temperature. And so that is not the sort of thing that you really want to be happening in your body, if you can possibly help it. So boiling of body fluids is another hazard that's a result of reduction of the air pressure around the body. In 1875, now ballooning was becoming a competition between teams and countries. Who could go higher than anybody else? And there was an enormous pressure felt by some of these people who wanted to be the highest, to go to the highest altitude. And the balloons now were being lifted by hydrogen, not by hot air. And here we see a very famous flight which went to 8,785 meters. And the three gentlemen are Civelle, who you see here on the left. And Civelle's job was to release these bags of sand. You can see he's got a knife and he's just about to cut that bag loose, and you can also see there's a little loop of rope here, so that when the bag is cut by Savelle, it will drop open and the sand will drop out, as has happened in that bag there. So they're going up. Tissandier is reading barometers. He's saying, okay, we're at such and such a barometric pressure now, and that would give them some sort of idea, rough idea of altitude. And Crochet Spinelli has got a device here, which is a fluid-filled jar. And the reason for that is that in these bags, in these balloon-like bags at the top here, is oxygen-enriched air. They realized that they would probably need to have extra oxygen. They'd spoken to a very famous physiologist called Paul Baer, who's the father of aviation medicine. And he had said, look, you chaps need to take some oxygen with you, otherwise you're going to get into trouble. So they took these three balloons with oxygen-enriched air. Tragically, it wasn't enough. And it was a very sad event because Baer found out that they hadn't taken enough oxygen. He'd tried to get a message to them before they took off saying, look, guys, I don't think you're going to take enough oxygen, but the message didn't arrive in time. So it was a great tragedy. Only Tissandier in the middle, the gentleman in the middle, survived this. But it brought home to everybody how important it was, how dangerous it could be to go to altitude, that lack of oxygen could be lethal, as it was in this case. So what can we do about this? This is just a generalization, but what could we do to stop this? Okay, we can do two things. We could surround the body, say, in a strong metal container, and we could introduce oxygen, and of course, if we do that, we introduce gas pressure. So we could add to the container gas, containing sufficient oxygen for our needs, and sufficient gas pressure to press onto our body to stop the effects of low gas pressure on our anatomy. And the ways to do this are twofold, basically. One is to have a pressure cabin, and if you can't do that, well, perhaps you could wear a kind of suit that you could introduce oxygen or gas, oxygen to, and produce the gas pressure. So there are two ways of getting around this problem. One is the pressure cabin, and the other one is the pressure suit. In 1872, Jules Verne wrote a sequel to his novel, To the Earth and From the Earth to the Moon, and he wrote the sequel was called Round the Moon. The novel From the Earth to the Moon ended in a rather dramatic way, almost presaging that he was going to write a sequel, because the astronauts, or the space nauts, were left in limbo, having just about got to the moon. He finished the novel that way. So he then wrote Round the Moon, and we see the space voyages here in the rocket. And interestingly, Verne uses one of his characters, Michael Arden. Michael Arden said, perhaps we could go outside, but to go outside, we'd probably need to wear something like a diving suit, and we'd have to supply air to it using a pump. And so Arden was suggesting, this is probably the first time that a spacewalk was suggested, and that the idea of having a pressure suit was suggested by Verne. I don't know of any earlier reference to that, but there may be. So what was Verne talking about? He was talking about the Siebe-Gorman diving suit. The Siebe-Gorman diving suit had an extremely long history. It was invented in 1850, and as a child I saw people wearing a suit examining the jetty at Port Nolunga, and it would have been about 1950. So I've actually seen somebody wearing this, and it was only in the 60s that this went out of fashion and more modern technology came in for diving. This is called the hard hat diving suit, for obvious reasons. It has a metal helmet. You pump the air down the tube, goes into the suit, supplies the diver with air, and that's really all you need. Underwater is the air to be sufficient pressure so water doesn't invade the suit and gives the diver oxygen. the Seed Gorman diving suit. And here we see a fascinating little article, little story, a honeymoon in space, and that appeared in a journal called Pearson's Weekly in 1900, and the artist is Stanley Wood. And I find this an absolutely fascinating little drawing because, illustration, because it has a whole lot of interesting little features. The more you look at it, the more you see interesting things. Here they are honeymooning on the moon. And they've come across an extinct species, an extinct moon species, obviously, of all these skeletons. But there are a couple of things about the suits that I find fascinating. Firstly, of course, they're just based on the Seed Gorman diving suit. But there are a couple of interesting subtleties that he's introduced. One is this gadget on the back, which is clearly some kind of life support system, presumably. So they're not using a tube coming from the spaceship and pumping the air from the spaceship. They're actually using devices that allow them to move about. But you'll see that, and I only noticed this the other day, you see there's a wire between the helmets. Why do you think they have a wire between the helmets? So they can talk to each other. And this is the early days of radio. So maybe radio hadn't developed sufficiently for them to think that they could have radios. It'd be too cumbersome. So they've got hard wire communication between the two of them. I find that fascinating. Why he would need a double-barreled shotgun is quite beyond me. But if you've got any suggestions, please say.
NRA.
Right. In the 1920s and 30s, the idea of a spacesuit was kept alive by the so-called pulp fiction comics or pulp fiction booklets. These were printed on very cheap paper, but they had lurid covers like this, which clearly were aimed to sell. Again, the illustration is quite fascinating from all sorts of aspects, including sociological. But you see here, we have the heroine who is carrying the hero, who doesn't look at all well. He's done something rather nasty to his fishbowl helmet and clearly is suffering from the effects of hypoxia. But the heroine is carrying on and carrying him through thick and thin, blasting at the aliens. But you'll notice she only needs a helmet. This is really quite fascinating. The female form is obviously quite resistant to decompression sickness and from tissue boiling. There were some early experiments going on. Because we now come to the stage of, it's not competition about whose balloon can go highest, it's now a competition about whose winged aircraft can go highest. And there was a very intense international competition going on. And here you see an early German suit by Klenke, and this is in the unpressurized state. And you'll notice that this has this ribbon, these ribbons tied around the suit, and you'll see in a moment why that was necessary, because there's no air pressure inside the suit. Then if we blow it up, boom! You see it becomes highly bulbous and balloons up and becomes virtually rigid and immobile. And the question then is, what can we do about this? Because clearly this isn't any use. You can't fly an aeroplane like this. You have to have some ability to move the arms and legs, to work the rudder pedals, to work the control column and so forth. If we take just an ordinary balloon and inflate it, as I've shown here, we have a relationship between the pressure and the volume. Of those of you who've done some physics will know that that's called Boyle's law. The pressure times the volume is a constant. If we then try and bend the balloon, then it is very difficult. It is quite difficult to bend the balloon. And there are various reasons for this, but one of them is that as we bend the balloon, the inflated balloon, it starts to kink or try to kink. In other words, the volume of the balloon is is going down. So as the volume of the balloon goes down, the pressure rises inside of it. So we end up with the same value for K on both sides. So this was a problem, that to try and bend these ballooned legs and arms, we were working against the physics. And the only way to get around that problem was to design joints that were what we call isovolumetric. That's just a fancy name for saying that when we bend, we need to design a joint that when we bend it, the pressure doesn't change in the suit and the joint will bend easily without difficulty for the pilot. So that kind of joint became the most important thing to try to develop for space suits and for pressure suits at this stage. How can we make the limbs flexible? How can we develop these isovolumetric joints? In the UK, there was also efforts to design a pressure suit. This is the same company that built the diving suits, the Siebe Gorman Company. The Siebe Gorman Company became involved in trying to build pressure suits for British aviators to break the world records, altitude records. And Professor Haldane was a famous professor of respiratory physiology in the United Kingdom. And he worked alongside Sir Robert Davis, and Sir Robert Davis was the manager of Siebe Gorman Company. So these chaps got together and built this suit. Again, the problem was rigidity and becoming inflexible and immobile when they were pressurized, but an altitude record was set by a pilot using this suit. Then we come to the Second World War. And as we know, and tragically it's so, that technology is pushed enormously during wartime. And Germany was being really hammered towards the end of the Second World War, the United States bombing in the daytime, the British bombing in the nighttime, German cities were virtually being flattened. There was a terrific pressure on the engineers and the physiologists and the aviation medics to try and come up with advanced aircraft that could intercept the bombers. And some of the work was towards what's called target interceptors, planes that can be placed around strategic things like ball bearing factories and artificial fuel factories. And one of those projects was Project Natter. And Project Natter was exceptionally advanced. It was a rocket-powered vertical takeoff interceptor. And the Natter was to reach 12 kilometers in the A version and 19 kilometers in the B version. Well, at 19 kilometers, you really do need a pressure suit. So the engineers were working, beavering away, and this is a pressure suit developed in about 1943-44, which is a very advanced suit. I'll just go through some of the features of this suit because it is really quite remarkable. At the shoulders and at the upper arms and at the wrists, they had things called ball bearing joints. These could be rotated using just ball bearing races, and I'll show you that in just in a moment. And here is the ball bearing joint. Now we're looking, so if we look at the joint that was on the upper arm, if we're looking at it like this, with that's where the rotation is going on, and this is the upper arm, and this is the distal part of the arm. And you see here that there's a cross-section through the joint, and here we have a ball bearing. But here is a very important little feature. That is a sealing ring to stop the gas from escaping from the joint. So the ball bearing joints played a really important part in making the German suit flexible. Then we have another thing you'll notice here, which is quite interesting, is called tucked joints at the elbows and at the knees. So if I take my trousers and I move the material up like that, do you see, if those of you can see, I've moved the material up and I've made a tucked joint. And that's what's going on here. But the other thing I'd like you just to note, because I won't be showing it again, are the incredibly detailed joints on the fingers. This is a major problem even today. Astronauts complain about their hands becoming tired when they're working on the International Space Station. It's still a big problem, and NASA runs a competition almost every year trying to get young engineers to make suggestions about how they can improve the flexibility of gloves. Glove design is more like black magic than a real science. But the Germans, these are fascinating. I'm not sure what these joints are. They could be tuck joints. I'm not sure. And unfortunately, there are no engineering drawings. The Americans might have grabbed them at the end of the war, but I am not aware of them. And if they are, they're still restricted. So this is the tuck joint, as I said. You see how the material is tucked up, then comes back on itself, and then comes up. And so you can move that joint, as long as you can stabilize it on each side. We have to put little straps here to stop it from just going like that when it's pressurized. But you can move, the fabric tends to roll over itself so that you can move it backwards and forwards, and it becomes what's called the isovolumetric joint. In 1943, and we're still in the Second World War, as if a lot of work was being done. The Americans were beavering away, not very successfully, as you'll see. But there was a chap called Russ Colley. Now, Colley is a unique gentleman who featured in development of pressure suits for aviators between the wars, and during the war, and after the war. So Russ Colley is a big deal in the United States with regard to pressure suit development. And he was in his garden, pottering around, and he looked down and he saw number 60. He saw a privet hawk moth larva, a caterpillar. And he thought, hey, this is lots of little segments. It's the body's segmented, and this little guy seems to be able to bend and twist and turn without any trouble. Maybe this is the answer that I'm looking for. Maybe the segmented joint is going to be what I'm after. And so he went back to the lab, went back to the engineering, and that was the outcome of Russ Colley's work. And it's called the worm suit because Americans, for some reason, as far as I can see, tend to call caterpillars worms sometimes, or at least that's what it's called, even though it's not a worm. It should be the caterpillar suit, I think, but anyway. And this is unpressurized. You see the segmentation at the knee joints and at the elbow joints. And you would hope that that would be helpful and would work. Well, here it is pressurized. And he's making a valiant effort to bend his left elbow, believe me. A valiant effort. But basically, that's what happens. It just goes, cring, exactly the same problem. The immobility is exactly the same problem. But it looks terrific. You know, from a science fiction artist point of view, I just love that. I think it's fantastic. And in fact, science fiction artists went bananas about this design, and it appeared time and time and time again. And here is the classic Destination Moon scene with the astronauts landing on the moon. This was Destination Moon was the first film to seriously look at landing a man on the moon. It was 1950 when that came out. And you see that the suits are based on the American worm suit design. You can see the segmentation of the elbows, a little bit on the shoulders, and the knee joints. And this is a good old Popular Mechanics magazine, which those of us who went through that era loved reading. This looks bizarre, and it certainly is a bizarre-looking thing, but in fact, it is quite remarkable. This is 1954 in the United States. This is called the Lytton suit because the company was called the Lytton Company, and the designer was Dr. Siegfried Hansen. I don't know whether he was German origin or not, but anyway. This is probably the first real space suit, and the major advance here was that there was an outer structure made of metal universal joints, which could move in various ways, but held their shape and held their structure. And inside Held inside there were a series of tucked joints, tucked fabric joints. So the tucked fabric joints, as we saw, is a useful thing, but we have to be able to stabilize them. And the metal exoskeleton, as you might call it, stabilized the tucked joints. And that worked brilliantly, absolutely brilliantly. And it was a really interesting thing. Why did Hansen want to do this? The reason was, and it doesn't make too much sense now, but in those days there were still valve-operated radios. The valve development was still there, although transistors were beginning to take over. And what Hansen wanted to do, he said, I would like my engineers to be able to work on the guts of valves and be in a vacuum. They have to be in a vacuum to do it, because inside a valve is a vacuum. So he's going to make the whole room a vacuum so his engineers could work on the interiors of valves. And that's why this came about. I'll talk a little bit more about these things, just a little bit early to introduce that. But there we go. So this, the arms were very flexible. Here it is in the pressure chamber. And this chamber has been decompressed to an altitude equivalent to 240 kilometers. This is a very, very high altitude. And there's equivalent to being in space. I mean, effectively, we're in space. And you'll notice the mistiness. Do you know what that is due to? Well, as we decompress, the air gets colder, and the water vapor in the air condenses out. And so we get this misting. But he was able to use the suit quite satisfactorily. You see he's gripping onto things here. He actually had little segmentations on the fingers. And so although the exoskeleton is covered by an outer fabric cover there, so we can't see it. But anyway, it worked very well. And tragically, the Lytton company was well ahead of all its competitors, but never managed to convince NASA that they should use Lytton designs. Lytton worked and worked and worked and was ahead of everybody, but NASA never gave them a contract. It was a real tragedy because he was a brilliant designer. So we come now to the space age, and then when the Americans were beaten into orbit by the Soviet Union with Sputnik 1. Here we are in 1961 in Project Mercury, the American project to put an astronaut into orbit, was coming to fruition. Alan Shepard, one of the first astronauts, is shown here, and he's wearing a pressure suit. It's very primitive. We're really going back. We're really we're regressing in a way, but there's partly a reason for that, and that is that the Mercury capsule was a pressure cabin, and the astronaut resided in the pressure cabin. The first defense for the astronaut was the pressure cabin surrounding him. The pressure suit was only there as a backup. If there was a sudden leak in the pressure cabin, then the pressure suit would hopefully save him so he could get back down to Earth as speedily as possible. But it had virtually no flexibility. This isn't pressurized. There was some attempt to segment the material, as you can see with these little strappings here, but basically, this was an emergency pressure suit to save the life of the astronaut if the cabin pressure failed. Just want to briefly mention Leonov's first spacewalk that ever occurred by cosmonaut Leonov in 1965. Leonov made the spacewalk okay, but the suit ballooned. And this was a real problem. This was a major problem because when he tried to get back inside the spacecraft, he couldn't fit through the airlock. And this was a do or die moment for this poor man. And the only thing that he could do, he had a little valve on the suit. He managed to reach that valve and managed to manipulate the valve so that he let some of the air pressure out. Now, this was a hazardous process, as you can imagine, because if he lets out too much pressure, he won't be able to have enough oxygen. And if he doesn't let out enough, he won't get back inside the spacecraft. But fortunately, he was able to reduce the pressure just so he could squeeze back into the spacecraft and avoided death by a very near margin. It just shows you that even here, they were really pushing the envelope to make political points in a way, I guess, which is rather sad. But here we are in 1963, and President Kennedy has said that the United States will try and land a man on the moon by 1969. Project Apollo was the project, as we all know. And here we see a very early version of the Lunar Excursion Module, the little machine that was to land on the moon, land two astronauts on the moon. And you can see that the astronaut here, or the engineer probably, is trying out a knotted rope in order to get down onto the surface. Quite bizarre. But I find it interesting because there's a ladder here that would eventually be used. But the fact that they were prepared to try a knotted rope suggests that the suit was going to be quite flexible, that the astronaut would have a flexibility of the hands to hold the rope and the legs to be able to hold the rope. So this would rely on a considerable degree of flexibility. The engineers were really pushed. If you couldn't have a man walk on the moon, what was the point of, you know, going in a way to look out of the window and say, hi, that looks great, and then coming back up again? So to achieve a man walking on the moon, which everybody wanted to see, the pacing item was the Apollo spacesuit. If that hadn't worked, then it would have been a different game. And so you see here in 1964, this is an early Apollo suit, and they have these interesting joints on the shoulders and elbows and hips and knees. And these are called bellows joints, and they really made this suit. They allowed great range of flexibility. They were very expensive to make. They didn't last very long. They had to be made for each mission and had to be made custom-made for each astronaut, so they cost a fortune. But they were effective and allowed the astronauts amazing mobility. So what is a bellows joint? Well, we're all familiar with a bellows joint. A bellows joint, here we are with a concertina, that's a bellows joint. Accordion. Well, yes, exactly. Well, it's the same with an accordion, but I thought this was called a concertina, but I stand corrected.
Well, let's give it to
Susan. Okay. But the interesting thing about the bellows joint is that it has to be stabilized. It's no use not having a stiffening device around the joint because the material would just balloon out. As soon as you tried to increase the pressure, the joint would be useless. So you have to stabilize the bellows, and you see these little things here are stiffening to stabilize the fabric of the bellows. And in the pressure suits, there are not only outer rings, not only outer stabilizing rings, there are also inner stabilizing rings that hold the material. And here is the final design of the Apollo suit. You can see the bellows joints quite clearly. There are fabric coverings over the bellows joints here. And the astronaut is wearing a bubble helmet. And over that suit, the thing that we see when we see these movies of the astronauts, so this is what we see. But of course, the guts, the really important guts of what makes it possible is the internal pressure garment that we just saw a moment ago. This is to protect the pressure garment from mechanical damage. It's to protect the suit from heat due to the sun, and also to protect the astronaut from tiny little grain-like micrometeorites that might strike the garment and cause a hole in the garment. And you see the back life support backpack here, which I'll just show you here. This is an amazing piece of equipment, and I won't have time to describe much of it, but I'd just like to point out that a few of the features of it. This is an emergency oxygen supply here, where the oxygen is kept at very high pressure. If this system breaks down, then the astronaut has enough time to get back into the Lunar Excursion Module. And here we have a reservoir which contains water, and the water's used going through a cooling garment that's like a sort of a long johns that has tubing in it and pumps cool water through the tubing, and the astronaut's body heat is exchanged into the water. And here is the primary oxygen bottle, and there's a little fan here that drives the air around. So it's an engineering marvel, and it took me a long time to even just get a general view of the aspects of this suit. And I do talk about that in my book. So if you're interested in some of the things There's a thing called the sublimator, which is absolutely fascinating, which keeps things cool. But I'll leave that to you to discover yourself. And in 1971, this is one of the Apollo missions. The suit worked fabulously. The astronauts were very pleased with it. Here's Apollo 15 and David Scott working on the moon. He just has to be a little bit careful because his center of gravity is probably out here somewhere. And you'll notice that if he tips too much further that way, he might fall over. But that's just an interesting little feature of that photograph. But the suits worked very well. Of course, dust was a big problem. And you can see the lunar dust covering the legs here. And that had to be contended with. So what's going to happen now? Will we go back to the moon? Well, maybe. It's really an open game at the moment. The Chinese seem very interested in pursuing it. The Indians are now pursuing space flight.
And let's not forget that Barack Hussein Obama cut America's space program in half.
Right, yes. Exactly, yes. Yeah. NASA's having a tough time, absolutely. But I think other people might pick up the game now, and the Soviets are interested still. So what do we need in a pressure suit in the future? Well, we need it to be hard-wearing, we need it to be easy to maintain, and we need it to be less expensive, if at all possible. And here you see some astronauts. This is a NASA rendition, some astronauts working at a lunar base. Or maybe we go back to Mars. Maybe not back to Mars. Maybe we go to Mars. Here you see what's called a hybrid suit. And this is an interesting development. NASA's spending a lot of time working on this kind of suit. It consists, and I haven't had time tonight to tell you about hard suits, but there's a chapter in my book about hard suits. But here we see a combination of what's called the hard suit. For instance, you'll see that the helmet and the life support system and the torso section are all one component. They're all one unit. And then we have fabric components here, or fabric-related components like the bellows joints and so forth. So this is called a hybrid suit because it consists of metal and fabric components. So the development of the space suit will continue as long as people want to embark on projects to discover our solar system. And I've only had a chance tonight to touch on some brief aspects of the spacesuit, but I hope I've whetted your appetite to know more about the development of the spacesuit.
Yes, there will be time for questions, so by all means do ask. Let me start with one about the Natter, for example. I was interested in that. It was an early jet plane?
Rocket-powered. It was rocket-powered.
But once it got up and it was chasing, it was supposed to chase fighters and things. How
yes.
did it manage to it would run out of fuel?
Very good question. Very good question.
They never actually got it operational.
It was a hybrid. It was partly an aircraft, partly a rocket, and it was guided. So there was an autopilot to fly the plane to the vicinity of the bombers. And there was, on the ground, there was a rangefinder which would sight on the bombers, and then a simple computer would compute the pitch angle that the Natter would need to achieve to intercept the bomber. And that data was fed, and I've actually been to the launch sites, believe it or not, outside of Stuttgart, there are three launch pads. And you can see the ceramic pipe where the cabling went from the rangefinder, which was about 300 yards away, through the ceramic pipe, and then up to the Natter so the autopilot could be programmed immediately before launch. The Natter would reach altitude in 60 seconds to 12 kilometers. And then the intercept would be maybe about another 10 to 15 seconds, because you would be right behind a bomber, you'd be right below and behind a bomber, and then you would fan fire the 24 Fon missiles. And then the plane would dive down to a lower altitude and the pilot would eject. So that was the mission profile.
Recoverable.
Yes, part of it was recoverable. They wanted to recover the rear fuselage with the rocket, with the fuel, yeah, with the rocket motor. Yes.
I'll have to borrow your book and read it.
Okay.
When you had that picture of cosmonaut Leonov, now the Americans all had opaque helmet visors. Now, because of the radiation, shouldn't his have been opaque?
Yeah, I mean, how much do you believe a Soviet photograph from... I'm not too sure how much. I think that photograph's been well worked. You just have to look at it and realise that there's been some manipulation of the photograph. So you're quite right. They would need to have a visor with filters. And, of course, Apollo had various filtering systems, yes.
I'm surprised you didn't mention that chap... a couple of years ago, Bowmaster, I think his name was. Incredible.
And I was watching the video on YouTube the other day, and Red Bull just released a new video of that jump. What sort of suit was he wearing?
Oh, that's a very good question. There's an enormous amount of secrecy surrounds these private attempts. There's just one about 10 days ago, wasn't there, I think, which broke the record again. And that was a privately built suit. And I'm sure NASA would love to have that information. But it's all privately funded. And so that doesn't enter the... I'm not aware that sort of material has entered the general, you know, public domain.
Actually, you've just done something probably useful in one of the Superman movies. Can you explain? Well, Superman 2 and 3, the crazies from Krypton come on the moon. There's a moon mission. Of course, there was none, but they had one. And at one stage, one of the crazies goes to the astronaut with the booster label on the suit and pulls it off, and it spurts a leak. Now, up to this time, I never realized, I'm not sure why, that the real suit was the one inside. That was just a fabric contraption. So that means that what they show in the film is complete nonsense, which is not surprising. What you said, this makes it so intelligently reasonable now as to how the spaceship works.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much.
Was there very much difference between the early Soviet cosmonaut suits and the Americans? Was Yuri Gagarin in a different type of suit from Alan Shepard, or did they have a pressurized capsule?
The early Soviet missions used a simple emergency pressure suit, like the Mercury suit. And of course, the Soviets very seriously intended to go to the moon, and it was only because the N1 rocket was just super complex, with so many rocket motors in the first stage that it was really, you know, an engineering nightmare. And von Braun had the brilliant idea of scaling up the V2 motor. And just giving it more and more and more thrust, and found the thing worked, and only had five engines, whereas the, you know, N1, I forget how many engines it had, but it was dozens. So yes, and so the Soviets did develop pressure suits, fairly sophisticated pressure suits with flexible joints and so forth. And I talk about that in my book, but I haven't had a chance tonight. The designs are a little different, but and cheaper.
How much are they worth?
I've got absolutely no idea, but I imagine that the Apollo suits each would cost millions, each suit. Yeah.
The question about those suits, you've spoken of Billy's joint, and that sounds really reasonable. I once was watching a crazy film, science fiction, and they had all this complex articulated structure at the shoulders. It's as if it was like a stiff section, and it seemed to rotate within it. And when I was watching, I thought, gee, those O-rings must be really great there, because it seemed as if each, there was a segment, it was rotating this direction, so that the arm could rotate. And the only thing that would come to mind that would allow that would be to have an O-ring in each of the points of movement. So, Velo's sounds really like a great idea. I'm not too sure about these films where they show articulated joints.
Well, of course, the Litton suit had an exoskeleton with universal joints. So that would look very complex if you watch that moving. I don't know whether there were ever movie films of that suit. The Air Force was very embarrassed about that suit because it mentioned the word that it might be a space suit. And at that stage, people were very anxious about things. It's unbelievable now, But at the time, in the mid-50s, you know, you had to be careful you weren't labelled as a crank if you thought that you could build a space suit. So, how we've moved on.
Jane?
Do the suit.
Yes, up the back.
Do the suits have a built-in toilet?
Yes. No, they don't have a built-in toilet, but they have a little nappy. A sheath. Yes, but not a proper toilet, no.
Well, that leads on to my question. What did they wear underneath the suit?
Yes.
Inside the suit?
Yes.
And were there any major differences between the men's and the women astronauts?
Well, we didn't have any women astronauts in Apollo. The International Space Station suits, I think they just provide a nappy-like device, which can be used for urination or defecation. Yeah. So it's not very sophisticated, no. And I suspect it's very similar in both. Yeah.
Whose suits do they use now? The Americans will go up in Russian ships, don't they?
Yes, and that's caused complications, hasn't it? Because you have to provide the facility to use both Russian suits and American suits. They do now. When the space shuttle, at one stage the Americans could only use their suits in the space shuttle. And when they moved to the International Space Station, they had to use Russian suits. But now I understand that they can use both kinds of suits. And the ISS, the International Space Station suits, are essentially based on Apollo technology. They're more, they've moved on, but I didn't go into that because essentially it's basically the same sort of technology. Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, on your behalf, I'd like to thank Brett again for coming and speaking to us. I think it's been absolutely fascinating. I mean, I was telling some people earlier, but I was fortunate enough to sit in an auditorium at Flinders University in 1969 to watch the men landing on the moon. And at one stage at the university, they were saying all lectures will go on, nobody is to leave, and no one's to watch. And then they changed it. And they put it on in all the lecture theatres, and we were able to go in and watch it. And, of course, it's something I'll never forget. And I'm sure that's the same for all of you people who remember those times. So it's been absolutely fascinating to hear the practical side of those suits. Now, I spoke to Brett last night, and he said, Jane Lomax-Smith had told me that we do have a space suit at the museum.
We have Andy Thomas's suit. At the museum, yeah.
Is it? I'm not sure if it's on display.
Yes, it's on display. Yes.
So if
in
you're...
In the mineralogy section on level 3.
Brett is also very heavily connected with the museum, so that's how he knows about all this. So if you want to follow it up, go next door in the next few days and go and ask to see the Andy Thomas suit, mm-hmm. and maybe then you'll be able to see the technology that Brett has described to you, you know, in the flesh, as it were. I'd like to present Brett with a set of gift cards and a $50 voucher so he can go and buy a book at UniBooks. UniBooks are one of our major sponsors of these talks. So thank you, Brett, on behalf of UniBooks and the library.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And the friends of the library will actually be taking Brett out for dinner after this. So we'll be having a fantastic conversation based on this tonight. Thank you very much for coming. A small group, but people who really were interested in the topic and asked great questions.